Now we tell a tale based on real events from 1992, a tense and atmospheric drama documentary of genuine heroism.
The Man Who Came Back by Matthew Solon. John Rowe recounts the story of the Shetland bus and the Norwegians who crossed the North Sea during the height of the Second World War to continue the fight against the occupying German forces.
The great events of the Second World War are well remembered, but for every grand strategy and mighty clash of arms, there are a thousand stories of individual courage, of unrecognized heroism. Every year the trumpets sound in Trafalgar Square, carols are sung, and a fir tree is lit with the playing white lights of a Norwegian Christmas.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is the 44th time that the city of Oslo has given a Christmas tree to the city of Westminster. It is given as a token of gratitude to the people of Great Britain for their unswerving help and support during the dark days of the Second World War. What you, Bridget, did for us, we will never forget.
This is not the story of what the British did for Norway, but of what a group of Norwegians did for their own country and their own people.
Die Ziele Deutschlands sind letztlich begrenzte. Wir haben uns mit Russland darüber ausgesprochen. Und das sind ja letzten Endes die letzten.
To be occupied is something that no nation wants, least of all the Norwegians. To begin with, the Germans told them they'd come as liberators, they'd come to help their brothers, their Aryan brothers. But that story soon wore thin when the jackboots started to come down, and Norwegians realized full well that they were in for what looked like a long period of German domination.
James Irvine was born and still lives in Shetland. He knows the story well, of the Norwegians who crossed the North Sea to Shetland and who then sailed back in the boats that had brought them to safety to continue the fight against the Nazi occupation. It's a story of small wooden fishing boats crossing and recrossing some of the most dangerous seas in the world to take weapons, saboteurs, radio operators and explosives to Norway under the eyes of the Germans and carry refugees back to safety in Shetland.
And to begin with, they operated from a little place called Catforth. And then it became clear that this thing was going to work. And they needed a proper base, secure, secluded, where nobody would be looking on. And a place called Lunna, way up north in Shetland, was chosen. And that was the first base for what became known in due course as the Shetland Bus.
SOE, Special Operations Executive, took over command of the Shetland Bus. A young sub-lieutenant called David Howarth was sent north to become its second in command. He was a naval officer, but the Shetland Bus was to totally ignore the traditional disciplines of the Royal Navy.
Most of the men were fishermen, and no fisherman of any nation can be driven. He's brought up to depend upon nobody and to call nobody his master. I soon learned that unless I was able and willing to explain step by step the connection between any job at Luna and the success of our voyages, it was better to leave the job undone. But petty troubles were forgotten as soon as our first operation was arranged.
That first mission was to take a messenger to a point north of Bergen to establish contact with a party of army officers who had begun to form an underground cell in Bergen itself. The boat chosen for this first trip was the Axel. The messenger's job was to find a certain lieutenant and tell him that a cargo of 8 tons of sabotage stores was ready in Shetland and waiting to be shipped.
Fitting out the messenger was my first experience of dealing with an agent's needs. Like most novices, I began with a childish enjoyment of the whole business, which in time gave way to an admiration for the courage of the agents themselves, coupled with a cynical belief that much of the gear we supplied them with might have been invented by schoolboys playing spies. For example, we fixed him up with a supply of cigarettes which had been specially manufactured without any name on the paper. but which would have given themselves away as British by the first whiff of Virginia's smoke.
By 9 o'clock on the evening of the 30th of August 1940, the Axel was ready to sail. Guns, food and stores had been loaded aboard and the messenger's equipment checked.
Minder, the ship's engineer, a gentle giant of a man, started up the engine. I saw him gleaming with sweat under the bright lights of the engine room. A change had come over the crew. I had never seen them so happy or so efficient. Auguste Neroy, the skipper, was laughing at Yertsen, who had chosen to sail in a rather smart grey lounge suit, a collar and tie, and a Homburg hat. Axel dropped her moorings with a splash. The tonk, tonk of her engine grew quicker, and we could just see the outline of her hull as she swung to the open sea. Then she gathered way and disappeared into the dark night. As she passed the entrance to the bay, she sounded her siren. It was the letter V for victory.
The first mission was a success. The Axel returned, her wheelhouse and superstructure decorated with bunches of heather and boughs of birch. The messenger had been safely delivered, and the crew of the Axel had gone ashore to enjoy the hospitality of good Norwegians, those who refused to collaborate. The crew even went to a village dance, inviting some local girls aboard afterwards for some real coffee and white bread. As the autumn turned into winter, confidence in the Shetland bus operation began to grow. In less than 3 weeks, 8 trips were successfully completed. Tons of supplies were delivered to the resistance. Howarth and the British servicemen who helped them prepare the boats were close to exhaustion, but the work went on. And always, there were reminders of the danger the crews, the secret agents, and the friendly Norwegians who helped them were facing. A message came through. A number of airmen, officers and radio operators had to come over to Shetland. The Germans were searching for them, and a rescue trip was urgently necessary. A rendezvous was arranged for one of the Shetland bus boats, the Eaglan, to meet the men at the head of Vinjefjord, 40 miles from the open sea, and with no alternative route of escape if the boat was detected. Skippered by Ola Grotel, the Eaglan reached the rendezvous. In his ship's log, Grotel recounts what happened.
2100 hours off Hovde. Hove to waiting for someone to come on board. 2130 hours. This all seems very mysterious. I've been waiting half an hour and no one has turned up. Going ashore to see what's up. 2215 hours, going full speed down the fjord. We got bad news ashore. At the first place we came to, they wouldn't say anything. They seemed to think we were Gestapo. We went on to the farm at Hovde. I felt sorry for the wife in the house. She was trembling with fright, so I knew something devilish was afoot. One of the daughters at the farm told us what had happened. The airmen and agents had been there, but yesterday afternoon German soldiers came and arrested all three and 2 men from another farm. The Germans were also searching for ships which might have picked up the men. All ships are being stopped and asked for passes. The fishermen even have been made to break open their herring barrels. So we didn't have much time for talk. We got on board in a hell of a hurry and got clear the way for action. We are going to put up a fight, however many there are in the pack.
Ola Grotel brought his ship home. Navigating by time and compass, the Eaglan steamed through the fjord on a night dark as a coffin. By 4:30 the next morning, they were safe to the west of the Norwegian coast. The next reminder of the danger everyone in the Shetland bus faced was even more immediate. Ingvald Johansson took his boat, the Vita, to pick up some refugees. It should have been a normal trip, but the Germans had traced the party of refugees, and when Vita turned a bend in a narrow channel, she was met by a German warship. The decks were swept with machine gun fire at point-blank range. Miraculously, none away with a party of refugees on the 27th of October. A gale was blowing from the northwest on the ship's starboard bow. Niels Nesser was at the wheel.
As the first grey light came into the sky, they apparently sighted a twin-engined aircraft to southward. The weather was so bad, with seas sweeping the deck, that all the weapons, the Bren guns and the Tommy guns, had been taken inside and lashed down. The aircraft turned, approached the Sea Glouse at mast height from astern, and opened fire with cannon. Some of the crew ran to the forecastle hatch. As they reached the door, the first burst of fire smashed it to pieces. The aircraft made a second run over the ship from the bow, firing with cannon from nose to tail. By this time, Bord Grotel had found a Tommy gun. As it made its third run, Bord emptied the magazine at the aircraft, which immediately turned into a wide circle and disappeared towards the east. Throughout the attack, Niels Nesser had stayed at the wheel, doing his best to steer a ship clear of the harm. But he'd been hit in the head and the leg. They saw him fall. They bandaged his wounds and carried him to a bunk. He died an hour later without regaining consciousness.
The Sea Glouse returned through heavy seas, not as some of the boats were, decorated with boughs of birch and bunches of heather, but with her superstructure riddled with shell holes, her sails in rags, and her mizzenmast cut nearly through.
There was no one at Luna to conduct Niels Nesser's funeral in Norwegian, but many of his young friends wept as the Scottish service, which they could hardly understand, was read at the graveside, overlooked by the sombre stone church.
We commend into thy hands, most merciful Father, the soul of this our brother departed, and we commit his body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, in sure and certain hope of the general resurrection in the last day, and the life of the world to come, through our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall fashion anew the body of our low estate, that it may be like unto his glorious body, according to the mighty working whereby he is able to subdue all things unto himself.
After the committal, the last post was sounded.
See, that was the first loss we had, but we were never gotten into a churchyard. There was loss of sea. Whenever we lost a man, it put a damper on the humor of the boys for maybe 2-3 days. But then, we know that we had to go someday, but when? When will our time come? So that was a big question.
It was a dark, dispiriting time for the Shetland bus. The death of Nesser, the capture of the Beta with all her crew, and now the Norsham, which had left on a mission 3 weeks ago, was long overdue. 13 men were missing, more than a third of the operation's seagoing strength. On the evening of Nils Nesser's funeral, David Howarth walked down the pier at Luna to discuss the situation with a staff officer who was on a visit from London.
I remember saying to him that I had little hope of seeing the Norsham again. She was so long overdue, I knew something serious must have happened. As I said the words, we both stopped. We listened. Was it? Seconds passed, and we heard nothing. Then, a shift of the breeze, and it came unmistakably. Donk, donk, donk. A Norwegian engine. It couldn't be the Norsken, and yet... And yet, if it was her, where on earth had she been all this time? The sound grew louder. We watched with aching suspense the point of land to the northward where the boat would first be seen. A mast appeared. It grew downwards as the boat cleared the slope of the hill until the stern was visible. It was not the Norsken. It was not one of our boats. But then she blew the V sign on her siren. It was our boys. I jumped into a dinghy and rowed out to meet them. Oh, by God, I'm glad to see you. Leif Larsen, Bjornøy, Pletten, Sangolt, Nippen. Where are the others? Where's Jetsen and Merkestahl? And what the devil is this boat you've got?
Cora Averson tells the story of what happened to the Norsken and her crew after they sailed from Luna on the 19th of October.
There was a boat left. It was called Norsken. With Jetsen as a skipper, Merkestahl as the engineer, and Larsen, Pletten, Bjornøy, and Nippen. There were crew on there. She was going into Norway as a mainland ship.
And they laid his mine in the area north of Christiansen. When he finished that job, he set off to go back to Shetland.
Turning for home, she met the full force of a northwest gale. Jefferson, the skipper, decided to go on. He wanted to be far away from the minefield by dawn, when the mines would be live and things might begin to happen. The Norsian was coming clear of the wave crests for half her length and was pounding heavily into the troughs. It was more than she could stand. Water began to pour through the inner planking on the starboard side. The cement ballast in the hold was breaking up. Either her bottom was stove in, or her keel was broken. The engine stopped. Foresail and mizzen burst into shreds and vanished. Nothing could be seen in the lashing of rain and spray. With only the small triangular sail set, and with the ship very low in the water, they drove at 6 knots towards the rock-bound coast.
Driven by the storm, the Norsian reached the comparative shelter of the fjord. In these quieter waters, her decks awash, she first listed and then sank. The crew managed to get the lifeboat clear and row ashore. As Cora Averson explains, the crew split up.
Jensen and Mikkelsen, they left Larsen. They were going another way, trying to get back to Shetland. And Larsen, Bjørnøy, Platten, and Nieper, they went along to Bjørnøy's father.
Leif Larsen remembers what happened next.
Going along to Bjørnøy's father was no easy matter. The region he lived in was 70 miles to the south. There were 3 wide fjords to be crossed, and between them, snow-covered mountains rising to more than 6,000 feet. Their first need was for warmth, food, and a chance to dry our soaking clothes. I knocked at the door of a nearby farm and explained who we were. The farmer showed us a small poster, which the Germans had decreed must be displayed in the wheelhouse of every fishing boat. It said, "Contact with the enemy is punished with death." I said, "Yes, I've seen that before. But the question is, who is the enemy? If you think we are your enemies, just say so and we'll go." The farmer thought for a moment, looked at me, Bjørnøy, and the others, and then opened the door to let us in.
The crew of the Norsian had begun their journey to freedom, crossing fjords by rowing boat, walking high mountain passes, where they noticed with pleasure that the pattern on the rubber soles of their British sea boots left a V sign imprinted on the snow at every step. Passing a convoy of 40 German army lorries parked by the side of the road, they reached at last the village where Bjørnøy's father lived.
They stayed there 2 days, sleeping in comfort and eating splendid dishes which Fru Bjørnøy and their neighbours cooked for them. By the afternoon of the second day, Bjørnøy's father had found them a boat for the journey to Shetland. The Arta, a fishing boat in first-class condition, moored not 2 miles away.
Larsen and the crew decided to take a few hours' sleep before stealing the Arta that night.
Our sleep was to be a short one. Early that evening, Fru Bjørnøy woke us up in alarm. The Gestapo were here, asking the neighbors' children if they had seen 5 men in oilskins and sea boots. Now they were searching the next house down the road. There was no time to lose. At that moment, only minutes away from capture, the air raid warning sounded, to be followed by the crash of RAF bombs and the sound of German anti-aircraft defenses blazing into action. In the noise and confusion, we rowed out to the Arta, slipped her mooring, glided quietly out of the harbour, and set course for Shetland. We were told later it was the British airmen who were blamed for pinching the Arta.
It was after that journey that Leif Larsen was elected skipper of the Arta. The escape from Norway was to prove typical of his deeds with the Shetland bus. A combination of leadership, unshakable courage, confidence, bravado, and luck.
He showed remarkable qualities. He had managed to do something that very few of us ever managed to do. He had managed to conquer fear. He was always calm, cool, and collected. And he took the most outrageous risks, but they came off. And of course the result was that he became the most decorated non-Briton ever.
David Howarth remembers Larsen's first trip as skipper of the Arta.
His mission was to re-establish contact with the agents in the district of Floro. To begin with, the trip went well. They made a safe landfall, found the local agent, handed over their cargo of explosives, and then gave him coffee, flour, tobacco, and a bottle of rum we had sent him for Christmas. The weather, up until then, had been good.
I said, "Larsen, you better lash on everything who's loose. on deck, because I think we get more of a bargain for. Says how, as you can see the color of the sky there. It's a sort of a brass, coppery color. Get a storm. I come and watch again at 12 o'clock, and the first thing I noticed was the bulwark on the starboard side was gone, and so much of the bulwark on the port side. And it was blowing like any tartan. And then the engine stopped. There was too much water, only 2 feet of water in the engine.
With her engine stopped, Arthur lay broadside to the storm. Lying low in the water and out of control, seas constantly broke inboard. To lower the level of water in the engine room was an immediate matter of life and death. In the extremity, it was not for an hour that they noticed that one of the crew, Sangold, was gone. Perhaps the first breaker had swept him off the stern as he was working with the mizzen. The sail he had gone to take in was still set, but he had vanished without trace.
Darshan gathered the surviving members of the crew into the comparative safety of the wheelhouse. For 4 days, the storm beat upon them. The mizzenmast was torn down by the wind. On the second day, a German plane emerged from the low cloud and fired a burst of cannonfire. Growing increasingly weak, the crew managed to hold the Arthur on course and keep the engine going. It was not until the morning of the fifth day they were able to make headway and set course for Shetland.
In the afternoon, we at Luna heard an engine with a great feeling of thankfulness. The Arthur's mizzenmast was lying on the stern in a tangle of rigging. The bulwarks were smashed and the gun mountings swept off their decks. Down below was a chaos of broken crockery and spilt food. That evening, as the crew told me their story and discussed the loss of their comrade, Otto Pletten and then Albertsen, Bjornøy and Larsen fell asleep in their chairs.
Relief at the return of the Arthur was mixed now with fears about Blear, another one of the Shetland bus boats, which had left Luna on a mission to pick up an agent from the island of Stord on the 9th of October.
That morning was sunny and calm, and when we all went down to the pier where Blear was moored to see her off, there was an even happier atmosphere than usual when a boat was sailing. The crew, going on their first trip, were like children waiting to go on a picnic. I cast off the stern ropes, and Kvalheim, a young man who had been working with us as a carpenter, stood by the forward spring. "Will you take me?" he asked eagerly. The crew shouted yes. Kvalheim turned to me and said, "Can I go? I'd like to do just one trip." The ship was already cast off, so I had to answer at once. "All right," I said, "but don't forget we want you ashore when you come back." He shook my hand vigorously, then jumped about 6 feet from the quay to the ship's rail. As Blear turned to head for the harbour mouth, the crew were waving, and Kvalheim was doing a fantastic dance on the forecastle. In this cheerful manner, 6 men left for their fatal trip, and I, by a quick decision, sent a 7th with them.
On her arrival in Norway, the Blear picked up a group of more than 40 refugees, many of whom were being hunted by the Gestapo. All were taken safely on board, but the congestion was appalling. On a calm summer's day, the discomfort would have been intense. But on her passage back to Shetland, Blear ran into the same storm with which Larsen and his crew had been struggling a few miles to the northward. She was never seen again.
The only times we deliberately relaxed were when boats came back from Norway, and we always found enough drink somewhere to give us a glow inside. But it was hard to sleep in a comfortable bed when one knew what the men at sea were facing. I used to lie awake listening to the swell of the storm. But there was nothing whatever that I or anyone else could do to help the men at sea. Their salvation lay in their own hands.
With the coming of spring in 1941, the nights became too short for the boats to cross in safety. It was time to take stock. The main change was to move the whole operation from the remote base of Luna to somewhere with access to proper engineering facilities. The site chosen was the village of Skalloway. One of the chief attractions of the place was the marine engineering firm belonging to Jack Moore.
Jack Moore? He was the hardest worker I've ever come across. One of those men who might wear a collar and tie and paddy hat, but who prefer to be up to their elbows, or further, in good black oil.
Jack Moore's job was to ensure the boats were fully prepared and seaworthy, and to repair them after their missions. Sometimes the violence of the North Sea storms would strip the decks clean of all their fittings. Sometimes the boats would be riddled with cannon fire from the German planes which pursued them. Standing in that same workshop, Jack Moore, now in his 90s, recalls an afternoon when Larsen returned to Scalloway with his boat badly battered by a storm. He immediately heard of a communication that the Gestapo was after a group of refugees, and he decided to go back at once to Norway.
Larsen says you would go. Hover says you can't. Look at the damage you've got. Larsen turns around. He says, what the sea is taken, we don't need anyway. If he was sent on a mission, he went on the mission. It didn't matter whether it was weather or aircraft. Or I called them all heroes, every one of them. But Larsen was certainly the leader.
Larsen needed all his powers of leadership for his next mission, an attack by fishing boat on the most powerful German battleship in the North Sea, the Tirpitz. Fast and heavily armoured, the Tirpitz posed a tremendous threat to the British convoys carrying vital supplies to the Russian port of Murmansk. The need to sink her was imperative.
At that time, the Royal Navy had just perfected a two-man human torpedo called Chariot. 20 feet long, it was driven by electric motors. The crew sat astride it in diving suits, protected by a kind of windscreen. On its nose was a large, detachable warhead, large enough to sink the Tirpitz at her anchorage in Trondheim Fjord. The Navy wanted us to get two of these machines with six men into the fjord. The choice of a skipper did not need discussion. Larsen was obviously the man for the job. He explained what was to happen at a specially convened meeting.
Gentlemen, their plan is to carry the two heavily camouflaged chariots on deck for the passage across the North Sea. Then, at a hideout among the maze of islands and creeks off the Norwegian coast, they will be hoisted overboard and towed underwater the last 100 miles past the German control point at the mouth of the fjord and towards the Tirpitz. Two strong eyeballs will be fitted to the keel of the Artois, here and here, to take the steel cable that will tow the chariots. That is correct, Miss Howarth?
That's correct. An extra bulkhead will be built in the cabin to create a hiding space for the chariot crews and for their gear.
Our ostensible reason for entering Trondheim is to deliver a cargo of peat from one of the Arthur Islands to the town.
Now, trials will be conducted in a remote sea lock in the northwest of Scotland, with the battleship HMS Nelson acting as target. Now, what about documentation?
The fishing pass, registration papers, crew list, crew passes, and the certificate showing Arthur's pass movements will be painstakingly forged. Mm-hmm. Everything from the deck mountings of the chariots to stores of tinned Norwegian food and German ersatz coffee will be carefully prepared, sir.
An adventure, gentlemen, fraught with danger.
Nothing will be left undone to ensure your safe passage through the German controls. But in the end, of course, Leif, it will be your courage and cunning that will be by far the most important factor in winning through. Finally, the day came for the Arthur to set sail. As she chugged out of harbour, her 55-foot hull was dwarfed by the bulk of HMS Electo, the submarine depot ship. Electo saluted her with a blast on her siren. Arthur answered in a similar voice, but proudly. I was proud of her too. So small a ship, and ahead of her, as Larsen had predicted, so great an adventure.
We crossed the North Sea in rough seas and a strong easterly wind. We dropped anchor in a small bay on a low island off the Norwegian coast. German planes flew overhead, but we managed to hoist a chariot overboard, where they hung down vertically on their towing wires. Next day we set off towards the fjord, the chariot streaming behind us, passing merchant shipping and German patrols. We spent that night at an island at the mouth of the fjord, where, with the help of some friendly Norwegians, we made emergency repairs to Arthur's engine. When daylight came, we were ready to begin the climax of our adventure. The moment had come to put months of preparation to the test. The English chariot crews crept into the secret narrow space behind the extra bulkhead. Once inside, they were in pitch blackness and could only guess what was happening from the sound of the engine and the footfalls on the deck overhead. The Artois passed through the minefields and defences, close to an armed patrol boat. As we entered the fjord below the massive forts which guarded it, we saw the examination vessel. German sailors stood at the rail, watching us. Bjornoy took the wheel, slowing her gradually to make sure the chariots did not overrun their wires and break surface ahead. Lines were thrown and the two boats touched. If any of the Germans had looked overboard, They would have seen the two mini submarines hanging below in the clear water.
Repair collision! Boarding party!
A German naval lieutenant jumped aboard and made for the after cabin.
Your coolest, please, sir. Ah, I see this was signed by Captain Koenig, an old friend of mine. I used to know him well in Bremen. I did not know he was in Ålesund.
Yes.
I see you've been in Kristiansund. How did you like it?
It was all right.
Your cargo?
Pete.
Pete? What is that?
It is dug from the islands for burning. We are taking it to the town to sell.
Ah, yes. Now I understand you. You have a radio on board?
No.
Any photographic apparatus?
No.
You have passengers?
No.
And a crew of four?
Yes.
And the crew is controlled? Yes. Your papers are in order. You are free to go.
The German sailors cast off the mooring lines, and Bjornoy put the engine in gear. We all of us held our breath for a minute longer, till the chariots were towing securely again under the keel. Then, in the highest of spirits, we went down to the engine room to let the British crew out and to tell them that the worst part of the job was over. Going along the fjord, everyone's excitement grew. There was nothing now between us and the Tirpitz, except 50 miles of fjord and the torpedo nets, which the chariot crews knew would not cause them any trouble.
The euphoria was not to last. After dark, there was an abrupt change in the weather. Larsen, his men and the British crew found themselves pitching into a steep, short sea. As they rose to the crest of a wave, they felt the tug of the towing wires on the keel. The bows fell into the trough, and when they rose again, the sharp tug was repeated. Then something hit the propeller. The chariots were gone.
We were within 5 miles of our target. We had passed through all the defenses. The Germans had no idea we were there. The way to the Tirpitz was open. But there was nothing we could do. The problem now was how to escape from the fjord. We could not take the Artur back through the same checkpoints, nor could we land to offload her cargo of peat. The only route to safety was overland.
The British and Norwegian crews launched the Artur's dinghy and rowed ashore. Larsen took Arta half a mile out into the fjord and opened her seacocks. The water flooded the engine room and rose until it stopped the engine. They abandoned Arta and left her to drift and sink. The British were wearing submarine jackets over naval battle dress, a uniform which made them more conspicuous but would perhaps give them the protection of prisoner of war conventions if they were captured. The Norwegians, in civilian clothes, could expect nothing but execution.
We began the journey through the 60 miles of woods, farmland and mountain passes that separated us from the Swedish frontier. At night, farmers and their families gave us shelter, though they were risking death or a concentration camp by doing so. Tired and slowed down by the snow, we came closer and closer to the safety of the border. As we did so, the attitude of the people changed. Farmers refused to help us. One of our Englishmen, able seaman Robert Evans, began to develop frostbite. Then, turning a bend in the road,
"Stop!"
They stopped, in the pitch darkness, at arm's length from two armed policemen.
"Go over and eat. Please take a shoot to me."
Larsen's party and the two Norwegian policemen opened fire at point-blank range.
"Shoot!"
Everyone scattered and ran. Able seaman Evans was hit and fell in the road. The others didn't know if he'd been killed or wounded.
But we could not go back to find out. The whole district was now on the alert. And even if Evans was alive and we could reach him, there was no way we could carry him over the last 10 miles to the frontier.
Larsen and the others walked on through the night to freedom. The Shetland bus missions continued. Sometimes the trips back and forth seemed almost routine. Years later, Larsen was asked what of the whole experience had been the most difficult.
I couldn't say exactly what was the most difficult. It was difficult all the time. The sailing. We were out at sea during winter time. The hard storms going into the coast in darkness. It was quite difficult. We were always looking out for German planes. Had a little fight or two with them, shooting at us. But we went through. Not all of us, though. I and a few others went through it all during the time we were going with the boats. but we lost 42 men during that time. And 8 of our boats we lost too. So we had rather heavy losses.
The failed attack on the Tirpitz was not the end of Leif Larsen's war. He had one more little fight to go through.
On a fine afternoon, returning from a mission, the Berkom was steaming on her homeward course about 70 miles from the Norwegian coast.
We expected a German plane to attack at once, so we dropped our camouflage and manned the guns. But it flew off towards the coast. The pilot must have reported our position. It was about 6 o'clock when the attack came. Two planes dived to Mars height, flying across our bows, firing their cannons. Clausen on the Port Lewis gun mounting was badly wounded by the hail of splinters. As the two planes circled for a second run, I tried to turn the Bergholm so that all her guns could be brought to bear. Another storm of shells and splinters hit her. Henriksen, at a twin colt, staggered away from his guns, with his face and hands hidden in blood, riddled with shells splinters from head to foot. Calve, at the bow colt, was hit in the hand and foot. As the planes roared by, he swung his gun round and aimed it with his remaining hand, then jammed his other elbow onto the trigger. In the next attack, Henriksen was hit again. Ferroy was also wounded, but stayed at his gun. One plane turned towards the coast. The other turned to drop a stick of bombs. Ferroy was wounded again and could do no more. Again the plane turned to attack. Another stick of bombs came down, and a lot of them fell a few feet from the stern. Vika was injured. When I ran to help him, I saw his foot was shot off above the ankle. 5 of the 8 men on board were out of action. I didn't know how we'd meet the next attack, but then I looked up at a second plane. It was disappearing to the east, damaged and smoking. The whole fight had lasted just over half an hour. Vika was dying. He was conscious and sometimes smiled, but did not speak or complain. Ferroy, Enochsen and Clausen were in great pain from the numbers of steel splinters in their hands, heads and bodies, and they could not move. The Bergholm was taking in water. The wheelhouse was literally shot to pieces and the engine had stopped.
Yes, mate.
We patched up the bullet holes in the lifeboat with canvas and sheets cut from bully beef tins. There was a grievous struggle to get the wounded men into the boat without hurting them too much. The 3 of us who were not wounded took turns in rowing, 2 at a time, each rowing for 4 hours and resting for 2. I decided to steer for Ålesund, where we had stolen the Archer the year before, and where I knew that Bjorn's father, who had helped us then, was in touch with the local radio operator. Calvo was able to bail with his undamaged hand, and he did so continuously. At 4 o'clock of the first morning, Vika asked for water and aspirins. We had no aspirins, but when I gave him the water, he seemed satisfied. When I went to him an hour later, he was dead. We wrapped his body in a blanket and lifted it overboard.
After 4 days and nights of rowing, Larsen and the survivors reached the coast. Fortunately, none of the German search planes which flew overhead spotted them. Their first contact was with the quisling skipper of a local fishing boat, who said he would use his influence with the Germans to help them. It might mean only a few months in prison, and then they could serve in the German merchant navy. This offer was declined. They pressed on and reached Bjørnøy's home. He and the people he knew, at great risk to themselves, offered shelter. Alerted by the quisling skipper, the Germans launched an intensive search. Advertisements offering a large reward for the capture of the shipwrecked seamen were printed in the papers. The reward was never claimed. The soldiers and aircraft failed to find the shipwrecked sailors. Bjørnøy's father got a message back to Shetland. It was far too dangerous for one of the Shetland bus boats to attempt a rescue mission. German activity was intense and every boat was being thoroughly searched. It was not until the bad weather changed to fair that a code message was broadcast by the BBC and a motor torpedo boat left harbour in Shetland. The resistance network functioned well. Next evening, when the MTB entered the small bay at Skorpen, the 7 men were waiting on the shore. Afterwards, Larsen said,
"We were glad to be on our way."
The days of the fishing boats were over. During that winter, we'd lost 5 of them and 42 out of the 100 or so men who sailed regularly. The crews were still willing to sail, but the price was too high and the chances of success too low.
Help came from America. Hearing of the problem, Admiral Nimitz, commander-in-chief of the American naval forces in Europe, ordered three U.S. Navy submarine chasers to be sent to Shetland.
They were bigger than the fishing boats and four times as fast, and equipped with every possible gadget and comfort for the crew. Central heating, an oil-fired galley, refrigerators, ice water fountains, hot and cold showers, and electric toasters. But more important, they were more powerful and well-armed.
The whole character of the Shetland bus operation changed. In the last year of the war, they completed 80 missions with no casualties. German aircraft flew overhead but didn't or wouldn't dare attack. The Shetland bus had come a long way from those first missions at the beginning of the war.
To ascribe glory to the violent death of any young man is only to add further folly to the failure of human wisdom, which is the cause of war.
No glory, but what of heroism? Who sings the hero? Leif Larsen was the most famous of the Shetland bus men. He won decorations from Great Britain and his own country, but he never wore them. Last Christmas, people crowding round the Christmas tree in Trafalgar Square were asked had they heard of Leif Larsen. Someone thought he was a long-distance runner. Another was sure he was the Viking who discovered America before Columbus. Most shook their heads. And what of the many others? Petten, Bjørnøy, Nessa, Gjertsen, Grotel, and the rest of the long list of Norwegian sailors who risked everything they had. The Shetland bus brought 350 refugees out of Norway, most of them fleeing from the Gestapo. Nearly 400 tons of arms and explosives were landed. The 60 radio transmitters and their operators provided Allied High Command with thorough information about everything the Germans did in Norway. The bus was a link in a chain that tied down 284,000 German soldiers. When the German garrison surrendered, it was to Norwegian fighters armed with guns which had crossed the sea from Shetland.
We can read about it and we can research it, but it's a thing that would have to be experienced to be realised, just what they went through and what they achieved. They saved ever so many lives. Every little thing they blew up, or every life they saved, how can we tell what went on from that? It's just a case of casting your bread in the waters.
At night, after they had completed their missions, some of the crews would pick the early spring flowers from the meadows of their homeland. Next morning, those flowers would be in Shetland, a promise of the liberation to come. And the Shetlanders themselves, who welcomed their friends from Norway so warmly.
Silent ye lie in distant lands and seas, heroes whose names we trace with love and pride. Endless our debt to you who fought and died, that we might taste the sweets of life and ease. Long shall the voice of fame your deeds recall, and glory gild your names on storied page. Noble and brave as in the Sea King's age, defenders of fair freedom for us all. High on the shining scroll of bright renown, emblazoned in the work wrought by your hands, refulgent now the name of Shetland stands, on through long ages to be handed down. Ever shall thoughts of your victorious strife stir Shetland's sons to greater, grander life.
John Rowe recounted the story of Leif Larsen and the men of the Shetland bus in The Man Who Came Back by Matthew Solon. David Howarth, Keith Drinkle, Leif Larsen, Ralph Beck, Grotel, Eric Allen. You also heard the voices of James Irvine, Kara Iverson, Jack Moore, Rhoda Bulter, and Mary Blance. Radio 4 would like to acknowledge the help given by the Norwegian Embassy, Radio Shetland, and the people of the Shetland Islands. The director was Martin Jenkins.